Let me just also throw in that in the 1950s, early 1950s and mid-1950s, some of Richard Nixon's first contacts with organized crime took place in the Havana casinos, where he was taken down oftentimes actually as a guest of various what one could call shady elements. And of course, Richard Nixon, despite the fact that he was holding no public office after the point where John F. Kennedy took office, plays a very key role in a number of situations here, and in other places is at best in what would be called, if it's a conspiracy coincidence, a very suspicious coincidence. So once again, as we probably will not necessarily have time to detail in the information section of the show, but we may respond to questions during the phone-in sections, Richard Nixon's ties also to organized crime began at the same time that much of this network of the CIA and organized crime was being set up, specifically in Cuba.
Yeah, indeed. At the same post-World War II period, Nixon usually attributes, or biographers of Nixon have attributed his political rise to an initiative undertaken by a mob attorney named Murray Chotiner. We're going to come back to Chotiner in the future. I don't want to devote too much time to him now. Now, it's worth noting, of course, as we just mentioned, that the mafia hated Fidel Castro. They wanted Cuba back, so they didn't need any prodding on the part of CIA to go and kill Fidel Castro. So now, Charles T. Cabell, the fellow we talked about as being the primary suspect in the deep sixing of the Bay of Pigs operation, his brother is mayor of Dallas and arranges JFK's fatal motorcade. Earl Cabell was one of the primary CIA officials in charge with recruiting three top mafiosi to
Charles Cabell.
I confused him.
Just wanted
to
make that clear.
Charles Cabell. Earl Cabell is the brother and mayor of Dallas. Charles Cabell is the general, so in case I make that confusion again. Okay, now, Charles Cabell, along with Sheffield Edwards and Richard Helms, two other key CIA officials, Helms became director eventually, go on and recruit. Again, the three mafiosi's names were Sam Giancana, usually known as Momo, who was capo mafioso for Chicago, John Rosselli, who was a former primary member of the Capone mob in Chicago, along with Jack Ruby, by the way. Ruby, and we're going to talk about his organized crime connections, Ruby began an organized crime as a group of teenage couriers for the Capone mob, working with Frank the Enforcer Nitti, who some of you may have seen a characterization of on the Untouchables TV show that still runs on a lot of VHF stations. Now, basically, the three mafiosi did not obviously kill Fidel Castro. What's worth noting here is that according to John Rosselli, and this information first surfaced in a Jack Anderson column, according to John Rosselli, some of the people recruited to kill Fidel Castro went on to kill John Kennedy. And this is, obviously, this brings us to the assassination of Kennedy, and it's worth noting here as well that the mafia hated John F. Kennedy at least as much as they hated Fidel Castro.
And a crucial point to be made here, however, is that, and this is something that has come up quite a bit lately in assassination research, or people wanting answers to the actual thing of if there was a conspiracy, then who did it? Well, one of the latest series of stories that has been floated is that the mafia was in fact wholly and totally responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, just to quickly address this point, and we'll address it in greater length later on, a very important thing that any kind of intelligence apparatus operation, an important thing to be aware of, is what the CIA calls modified limited hangout. Now, the CIA, anytime they engage in an operation, has a series of cover stories, a series of stratified cover stories, very much like, let's say, the rings on an onion, okay, the different skins of an onion. And some of the top ones are meant to be flimsy. They're meant to sow misinformation and to get people nervous and get people to start to doubt anything, because there's so many stories being floated around. Once these stories are peeled through, the CIA begins what's called the modified limited hangout. In other words, when somebody starts to close in on a CIA operation, and this is not something I'm making up, by the way, nip tuck inserts parenthetically, this is something that the CIA has come out in CIA documents. It's come out from people who've been in the CIA and have later gone on to talk about their experiences. The CIA then goes into the modified limited hangout mode. That's their slang for it. And what that means is that they will admit to something that is a very minor consequence, but that they have already been pinned to, and they'll say, oh, you clever researchers, you caught us, you found out the whole truth, that's it. Boy, you know, you're right, we did hire the mafia to try and kill Fidel Castro. The CIA then can feel that they have backed out without compromising any of their real secrets, or any other intelligence group can. I mean, it's not just the CIA, but they can feel that they have not compromised their real secrets while throwing a bone to the people who are investigating, who can then feel that they have solved the mystery. Now, I personally feel, and I think we'll prove this as we go along in the series, that this is, in fact, what the mafia story is. And as an illustration, before getting back to Dave, who's going to do some reading on the subject, an important thing to think about is the fact that it's a common thing, and a common thing known to any law enforcement officer. And I think that if you any of you folks know a policeman who's worked in the big city, in any big city in which there is a syndicate or organized crime involvement, that officer will tell you that the mafia, the Cosa Nostra, the whatever you want to call it, the syndicate organized crime, does not kill police officers if in any possible way avoidable, because of the fact that the things that come back on the mafia because of the killing of one of the upholders of society's virtues, if you'll have it, is so much worse than anything that the mafia can benefit. In other words, in some ways, the mafia will be allowed to slide and will be allowed to handle certain types of things, their drugs, their gambling, their vices, and the police will turn a deaf ear and a blind eye. But once a police officer has been killed, the police will descend with vengeance. And this is why the mafia kills other mafiosi, but does not kill police officers. And if you want to extrapolate out to the Kennedy assassination, it's pretty obvious that the mafia as a group would not have been responsible for the death of John F. Kennedy if they could possibly, unless they had some kind of word from the inside.
Okay. Now, and we're going to come back to the whole subject of could the mafia have done it in weeks to come. Now, it's important to note here that the mafia hated Kennedy and had many reasons to have wanted to kill him. And keep in mind, as we've just seen, that the mafia is, in a certain sense, inseparable from the U.S. intelligence apparatus. They're part of it. They've been working in conjunction with it, so really, it is sort of, in a sense, academic as to where the mob leaves off and the CIA begins. Now, these three mafiosi, Giancana, Roselli, and Santos Traficanti, were recruited by CIA to kill Castro, which they did not do. And as I mentioned, according to John Roselli, some of the mobsters recruited by CIA to kill Castro wound up killing Kennedy. Now, at this point, let's take a look at some of the reasons why the mob hated John Kennedy. First of all, they blame John Kennedy for the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation, and as such, were looking to avenge themselves on him in some fashion or another for having failed to regain their Cuban sanctuary for them. A second reason is that basically the Kennedy brothers had been extremely active against the mafia even before John became president and his brother Robert became attorney general. The Kennedys were both very active, Robert in particular, with the Senate's McClellan Committee, which investigated organized crime and the mafia relationship with the Teamsters Union and James Hoffa in particular. Now, when the Kennedys came into office, that is, John became president and Robert attorney general, they undertook a huge, literally a war against the mafia and directed the entire federal law enforcement establishment against the mob and were doing more against organized crime than anyone had done in a long time. And it is worth noting that there were numerous attempts to numerous accounts of the mafia threatening John F. Kennedy's life, and that's what we're going to turn to right now. I'm going to be reading to you from a book called The Hoffa Wars. That's an excellent book authored by a man named Dan Moldea, last name M-O-L-D-E-A. It was published in soft cover by Charter Books and was copyrighted in 1978. And in this particular passage here, we're going to see that I'm about to read you from Moldea's book. We're going to see threats against the life of Kennedy by two key mafiosi. One of these was Santos Traficanti, who is generally believed to be capo mafioso for Florida and in charge of the entire Cuban mafia connection. And he was one of the fellows who we're going to see uttering a threat against Kennedy's life in the same month as another key mafioso, a man named Carlos Marcello, last name M-A-R-C-E-L-L-O. Traficante, by the way, is T-R-A-F-F-I-C-A-N-T-E. Now, Carlos Marcello was capo mafioso, head mafioso for New Orleans, and he was named by the House Select Committee to investigate assassinations as a probable conspirator in the assassination of Kennedy, interrupting the House Select Committee on Investigation, the House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded that there had been a conspiracy to kill both John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and they named Carlos Marcello as a probable conspirator in the JFK case. Now, keep Carlos Marcello's name in mind here as you listen to this, and keep Santos Trafficante, who along with John Roselli and Sam Giancana were recruited by Cabell and the rest of the CIA to kill Castro, and according to Roselli, they wound up killing Kennedy. Now, reading once again from The Hoffa Wars by Dan E. Molday. That month, as word of Valachi's cooperation leaked out, that, by the way, refers to Joe Valachi, a turncoat mafioso who spilled a lot of key information to the Congress about the mob. Beginning again, that month, as word of Valachi's cooperation leaked out, Carlos Marcello met with his top henchman in a cottage near New Orleans. During the meeting, Marcello, according to a report, was in a frenzy about Robert Kennedy and especially Marcello's own recent kidnapping, which had been engineered by the Attorney General near the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Both Marcello and Russell Bufalino had gotten deportation orders and were battling the government with the same attorney. Russell Bufalino was an organized crime figure as well and a close associate of Jimmy Hoffa. In the Marcello kidnapping, federal agents sent by the Attorney General arrested and handcuffed Marcello as he was walking down a New Orleans street. They drove him to a nearby airport, loaded him onto a private plane, and flew him out of the country. Since he carried a Guatemalan birth certificate, it was assumed that he was a native. After 2 months in Latin America, Marcello illegally flew back into the United States on his private plane, piloted by David Ferry, last name F-E-R-R-I-E, an anti-Castro activist. Interrupting here, keep in mind the name David Ferry. We're going to come back to him. I'm not going to interrupt here anymore to explain who he was. Remember the name. Back in America, Marcello began his successful appeal to fight permanent deportation, claiming that he had been sent away with no opportunity to call either his family or his lawyer. Marcello reportedly worked himself up over the incident and finally shouted an ancient Sicilian death threat against the Kennedy brothers. Levarsi na petra della scarpa. Take the stone out of my shoe. He then announced that John Kennedy was going to be assassinated and that a nut, unquote, was going to be hired to handle the job. This recalled in 1962, a year before the assassination. That same month, Marcello's friend Trafficante, still involved in the CIA murder plots, was talking to Jose Aleman, last name A-L-E-M-A-N, a Cuban exile financier who was a respected FBI informant, about his hatred of the president. Have you seen how his brother is hitting Hoffa, a man who is a worker, who is not a millionaire, a friend of the blue collars? He doesn't know that this kind of encounter is very delicate. Mark my words, this man Kennedy is in trouble and he will get what is coming to him, unquote. Aleman, who was talking to the underworld leader about a $1.5 million Central States pension fund loan, which Hoffa had personally cleared for Trafficante, responded that President Kennedy would probably be elected to a second term. No, Jose, Trafficante said firmly, he is going to be hit, unquote. When asked during the research of this book who was making the arrangements for the president's assassination, Aleman said that Trafficante had, quote, made it clear, unquote, that it was Hoffa. Okay, interrupting here very briefly, it's worth noting, I think, a little bit of postscript to this particular alleged assassination attempt against Castro and possible successful attempt on the life of Kennedy. Now, in 1975 and 6, the Senate Intelligence Committee undertook to investigate the CIA attempts against Castro and specifically to investigate whether Roselli's claim that this charge had backfired and resulted in the Kennedy assassination, whether there was any validity to this. Now, Sam Giancana was under FBI surveillance and police surveillance. He was to appear as a witness before the Senate Intelligence Committee. 2 weeks before he was to appear, he was murdered, found shot 6 times in the neck and face in his own home, supposedly while under FBI and Chicago police surveillance.
With friends like that, who needs enemies?
Well, now, not only that, but the Senate was less than thrilled by this. They asked the FBI to investigate Giancana's murder. The FBI, under then-director Clarence Kelly, refused on the grounds of a technicality. Now, here's a Senate witness murdered, and the FBI refuses to investigate. Now, later, the following summer, John Roselli, in April, testified secretly. Johnny Roselli, the second of the triumvirate recruited by CIA to kill Castro. Johnny Roselli testified in April in secret before the Senate Intelligence Committee. In August 10th specifically of 1976, Johnny Roselli's decomposing and dismembered body was found floating in an oil drum in Biscayne Bay in Florida, which also is where Nixon called home, by the way. Now, interestingly enough, again, the Senate asked the FBI to investigate this murder. Again, the FBI refused to investigate the murder of a Senate witness. At this point, the Senate convened and began discussing this, and there was apparently, according to Bernard Fensterwald, in coincidence or conspiracy, in essence, the Senate staged a little session where they threatened to undertake an investigation of the FBI's role in looking into the JFK assassination, and at that point, the FBI agreed reluctantly to investigate the death of Johnny Rosselli. Now, Jimmy Hoffa, who was named by the recently deceased Jose Alemán, he died in a shootout with the Miami police recently. Jimmy Hoffa, who supposedly was organizing, according to Jose Alemán, who was organizing the attempts on Kennedy's life by the mob, Jimmy Hoffa disappeared roughly a month after Sam Giancana was murdered in Chicago, and his body has never been found. And worth noting, too, that Jose Alemán's father was a Batista official, left when Castro took over Cuba, and the Alemáns have been very much involved and very lucratively involved in the powerful Cuban exile community in Florida. So an interesting postscript to what happened with these fellows who were involved. Santos Traficante, by the way, was served with a subpoena to testify in front of the committee. He was visibly shaken, according to the person who served him with the committee. His hands were, with the subpoena rather, his hands were trembling and his face was white. And this from an individual who didn't blanch it very much. It took a lot to shake up Santos Traficante.
Amen.
Now, returning again to Santos Traficante, returning again to some possible mob connections to the assassination of President Kennedy, it's worth noting here, and bear in mind Hoffa's antipathy to the Kennedy brothers, it's worth noting that Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald before he could come to trial and silenced him, Jack Ruby had numerous ties to organized crime and numerous ties to the Hoffa mob. Returning once again to the Hoffa Wars by Dan Mulday. Interestingly enough, Jack Ruby, there is an indication that he may have met with Santos Traficante in Cuba on what looks to be a possible intelligence mission. And Mulday writes in the Hoffa Wars as follows. Another possible piece of the Jack Ruby puzzle comes from a CIA memorandum of November 26, 1963, which reports that a British journalist, John Wilson, informed the American Embassy in London that while in a Cuban prison in 1959, he met, quote, an American gangster named Ruby, unquote. Wilson, jailed by the Castro government and then deported to England, said that he had also become acquainted with, quote, an American gangster gambler named Santos, who could not return to the USA because there were several indictments outstanding against him. Instead, he preferred to live in relative luxury in a Cuban prison. It was Santos whom Ruby, quote, visited frequently, unquote. Wilson's Santos was a perfect description of Santos Traficante, who was indeed in a Cuban prison during mid-1959 and had criminal charges against him in the United States. Although Jack Ruby and Jimmy Hoffa shared some of the same friends, including Paul Dorfman and David Yaris, as well as associates of Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello, and Santos Traficante, that alone does not represent a direct relationship between them. Recalling now that Ruby, as mentioned a couple of minutes ago, was a member, basically, of the Capone organized crime organization in Chicago from the time when he was a kid in a youth gang that basically ran messages and bottles of booze for the Capone mob. Now, some much more interesting connections here between Hoffa people and of course, Hoffa's involvement with organized crime was massive. Between Hoffa people and Ruby are delineated here by Mulday. Now, what Mulday is going to be talking about here are some interesting phone calls between Jack Ruby and two Hoffa organized crime associates named Barney Baker, who is basically Hoffa's chief strong-arm man, and a Hoffa attorney named Irwin S. Weiner, last name W-E-I-N-E-R, Weiner being basically, as I said, an organized crime attorney closely affiliated with Hoffa. And in the weeks immediately prior to the assassination of Kennedy, Jack Ruby called both of these men, and the interesting circumstances surrounding these calls is related by Mulday as follows in the Hoffa Wars. Interestingly enough, however, on October 26th, 1963, Ruby placed a long-distance call to Chicago to SH36865. FBI records established that this 12-minute call went to Irwin S. Weiner, W-E-I-N-E-R, a veteran member of Hoffa's closest circle of underworld advisors and the major bondsman for the Teamsters Union. By the late 1950s, according to Walter Sheridan, quote, Weiner was representing himself as the exclusive agent for the Teamsters Union bonding, unquote. Speaking from his still-thriving bonding business in Chicago, Weiner says that he and Ruby were personal friends. Ruby was a friend of mine. He called me. I talked to him. What I talked to him about was my own business. And I just don't feel that I should discuss it with anyone. It has no relation, it has no bearing on anything, unquote. Weiner adds that he had known the Ruby family since the early days on Chicago's West Side, when Ruby's brother Earl was one of his best friends. I was in fairly regular touch with Earl. He was one of my closest friends from back in school. Later he moved to Detroit, where he opened up a laundry business, Kobo Cleaners, in about 1961. 4 days after the call to Weiner at 9:13 p.m. on October 30th, Ruby called CH25431 in New Orleans and spoke to Nofio Pecora, P-E-C-O-R-A, a key member of Carlos Marcello's tightly knit apparatus. Pecora's brother-in-law, Dalton Smith, was Marcello's closest underworld advisor and frontman. Smith was, incidentally, associated with two other Dallas friends of Jack Ruby. Second, Pecora's sister-in-law was the wife of Joseph Poretti, who managed some of Marcello's real estate holdings, coordinating them with the mob boss's $500 million gambling network. And Pecora's wife, formerly in business for herself, was now Marcello's secretary. In an analysis of the Marcello empire, Aaron Cohn, KOHN, a respected authority on organized crime, noted that, quote, Nofio Pecora is an ex-convict with extensive past history in the heroin trade. He and his wife directed a call girl ring between Louisiana and Mississippi. On November 7th at 2:12 p.m., Barney Baker, a former street brawler and prizefighter who was one of Hoffa's top aides before Robert Kennedy put him in jail, called Ruby from Chicago. There is no record of an initial call to Baker from Ruby, although Baker claims that he was simply returning a call from a Dallas nightclub owner whom he did not know. So, recall, summing up again, interesting phone calls in the weeks prior to the assassination between Jack Ruby and Hoffa bondsman Erwin Weiner, Hoffa strong arm enforcer Barney Baker, and key Carlos Marcello associate Nofio Pecora, and recall the threat against Kennedy's life made by Marcello that we discussed a minute ago.
All right, and the key point here with Jack Ruby is to remember that a little later on, most notably probably next week, when we're talking about the actual events of the assassination, you will know, and if you do not know already, that Jack Ruby managed to, as he claimed, coincidentally be just in the area where he happened to be able to find the 20 seconds when Lee Harvey Oswald was available to be shot, and did in fact shoot Lee Harvey Oswald, claiming that he had no other motive than to spare the president's widow from the suffering of having to come back to Dallas to testify. And then, of course, Lee Harvey, Jack Ruby later on came up with some rather interesting contradictory testimony that, in fact, he was not allowed to give outside of Dallas. And we'll talk about that at some length. So just remember Jack Ruby's very tight ties to organized crime and his suspiciously close ties immediately before, in terms of contact made immediately before the John F. Kennedy assassination.
Now, recall how when we dealt with the Francis Gary Powers book, Operation Overflight, Powers was the first of many to intimate that Lee Harvey Oswald was basically a Soviet sympathizer or agent who was responsible for downing the U-2 and consequently scotching the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Now, Oswald did indeed emigrate to the Soviet Union. While in the Soviet Union, he got a job at a radio factory, was interviewed by a number of people in the U.S. Embassy, all of whom later turned out to be CIA officials, or agents, I should say. And then, despite the fact that he had supposedly committed treason against the United States and espionage by revealing top-secret information on North American air defenses as well as the U-2's radar situation, that he then encountered remarkably little difficulty in getting back into the United States. He did this, the action of getting Oswald back into the U.S. was initiated through a letter to Texas Senator John Tower, who became chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Oswald got back into the United States, was never indicted or prosecuted for his espionage, and was able to move about the United States rather freely. Now, one of the interesting things is that Lee Harvey Oswald began work on behalf of Fidel Castro, or at least allegedly so. He became not only the head of, but the sole member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, and as it turned out, he was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, but he was not the only person who hung around their headquarters.
Let me stress also this point that Dave is making. Now, on one level, now remember out there, those of you who are not so familiar with some of the subject matter that we're talking about or with the dealings of intelligence, it is very important to remember that the key thing going on here is the difference between reality and appearance. And in this case, Lee Harvey Oswald, who defected to the Soviet Union claiming that he was going to give away all of America's top secret information on air defense and things of this nature, went to Russia, came back, and as a matter of fact, in the process of moving back, I believe he even received a $400 loan from somebody in the government through the State Department to enable him to finish up his affairs and to be able to get back to the United States. When he came into the country, he was never what's called a post-situational interview. He was never debriefed. Thank you very much. He was never debriefed. As a matter of fact, the only person out to meet this heinous defector who'd gone to the Soviet Union, our Cold War enemy, in pitched battle to give them all of our air secrets, the only man out to meet him was a gentleman by the name of Spaz T. Rakin, who was theoretically was a representative of Traveler's Aid, but was in fact a representative of several Eastern European, violently, almost fanatically anti-communist groups who came out in a very friendly manner to meet this Soviet defector, this pro-Castro, pro-Russian defector, instead of any kind of government official who might want to know what Lee Harvey Oswald had talked to the Soviets about while he was in Russia.
It's interesting, too, that Oswald, the supposed leftist, associated with an enormous number of right-wing people. Now, something we're going to talk about next week and in weeks to come concerns the fact that the address for Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, recall he was its only member, opened on, it basically was in a building which had another entrance on a different street. One was 544 Camp Street and one was 541 Lafayette Place in New Orleans. I can never remember which was which. Which was the head of the, which was the headquarters of the so-called Fair Play for Cuba Committee and which was an office of a former FBI agent and ultra-right-winger named God Bannister.
544 Camp Street was the address on Oswald's literature. And again, we're talking about appearance versus reality. Lee Harvey Oswald has had a series of handbills printed up that said the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, of which he was only the treasurer, supposedly, and it had an address of 544 Camp Street. In reality, he may have been the treasurer. He also would have had to have been the president, the vice president, all the members, because as Dave said, he was the only member. And 542 Lafayette Street was the address kitty-cornered. In other words, it was a building on a corner. One corner was 544 Camp Street. The door on the other corner was 542 Lafayette Street. They both led up to a first-floor landing, and the office space shared on that first-floor landing with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee was the offices of a detective who was a former CIA FBI agent who had many contacts with the anti-Castro Cuban crowd and the Bay of Pigs crowd by the name of Guy Bannister.
None of that, but Guy Bannister was affiliated with Division 5 of the FBI, which is the Internal Security Division. Now, Oswald got in a very highly publicized street altercation with a guy named Carlos Bringer, who is a Cuban exile affiliated with CIA, and this resulted eventually in an on-air interview between Oswald and a couple of individuals that Nip Tuck is going to tell you about. And this is interesting because this interview certainly laid the groundwork for representing Oswald as a communist sympathizer, if not indeed a Soviet agent, whereas the official version of the Warren Commission's thesis, the Warren Commission thesis was that Oswald was a lone nut. And when the facts of the situation are examined, Oswald's contacts appear to be overwhelmingly not only right, but far right. And it's worth noting here that there was a definite and apparently deliberate effort to represent Oswald as a leftist and to achieve a great deal of publicity with this effort.
Okay, I'm going to be reading from a book entitled Conspiracy. It's by Anthony Summers. It was published in 1980 by McGraw-Hill Books. As a matter of fact, got a lot of very good reviews when it came out, a very scholarly book on the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald and his intelligence contacts.
Summers is a BBC reporter who was commissioned by the BBC to undertake its investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
All right. Once again, reading from Conspiracy and talking first and foremost about a man named Carlos Bringer, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald had a very publicized shoving match which enabled him to become known in media circles as a Marxist, because, of course, then he was dragged onto radio programs and interviewed by newspaper reporters, because somebody who was willing to go out in public and hand out handbills for Castro in those days was quite a bit more visible than they would be these days. So once again, that's the first person we're going to be talking about, is this anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Carlos Bringuier. And I read from Summer's book as follows. Carlos Bringuier, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had contact with the CIA. He was a New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringuier had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami, and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency, that's from the CIA itself, reveals that the CIA had, quote, past contact with Carlos Bringuier. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than, quote, Domestic Operations Division. The clandestine department, which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Let me go back and just restate that real quickly. The agency's own memos revealed that they had had past contacts with Carlos Bringuier, which they claimed the contact was limited to domestic service activities. However, and I quote again from Summers, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title, namely Domestic Services, rather than Domestic Operations Division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringuier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. The committee was funded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringuier called William Stuckey, a young reporter who had a weekly radio program on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly, quote, deliberate, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out aloud large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon the industrious Bringuier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda information called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA, I-N-C-A. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee. The very title, Council of the Information Council of the Americas, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA.
Okay, now we're in just a second going to play you the interview, a tape of the interview that was conducted by Jim Stuckey, Ed Butler, and Carlos Bringuier with Lee Harvey Oswald on WDSU. Now, before we get into the tape, two details that I'd like to call to your attention, two things to pay close attention to. First of all, in the very beginning of the interview, Lee Harvey Oswald is going to be asked a question about his status, about the status of his citizenship while in the Soviet Union, and his reply is very halting. He stutters, but he initially says that at all times while in the Soviet Union, he was under the protection of the United States government, and then he quickly... He hems and haws and backtracks and negates that.
Now, again, just to clue you into this stuff, because it all goes by rather quickly, a very odd thing for somebody to say, or even to claim any kind of connection with the U.S. government, for somebody who is supposedly and purportedly defected to the Soviet Union because of his disgust with the United States and with the avowed purpose of giving away America's military secrets.
Also, take note of the fact that Carlos Bringier, right, the member of the DRE, the CIA-sponsored Cuban student group, that Carlos Bringier asks a very provocative question of Lee Harvey Oswald. He mentions that Castro characterized President Kennedy as a ruffian and a thief, then asks Lee Harvey Oswald whether he agrees with Castro's characterization of Kennedy. This is worth noting because the tape of this interview that we're going to play was broadcast all over the United States the evening of the assassination. So basically what you're about to hear was heard by all of America on the evening that JFK was assassinated.
All right. So once again, this is William Stuckey's radio interview, and the participants are the people that we have outlined. Carlos Bringier, a anti-Castro Cuban with CIA contacts. Ed Butler, a very prominent right-winger, later with contacts to the John Birch Society and other groups, also with CIA contacts. And Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Stuckey and I are talking with three guests. Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Yes, Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree because of the fact that you refused to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers, and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just one second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I've already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner, to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy getting this permission.
Were you ever in a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, well, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Mr. Butler, let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right to this extent. We should get around to the organization which he is the head of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Committee. Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist-controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree. I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugarcane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
All right, and that was the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald, as well as the others introduced. And some rather interesting things that we pointed out before, which we hope you got a chance to catch, and some rather interesting things set up for all time. And one, again, cannot help but notice the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist, supposed communist with no organization whatsoever, managed to make his Marxist sympathies and his relationship to the Castro regime and the Russian government awfully well known for a man with a committee of one.
Keep in mind that this interview was in August of 1963, about 3 months before Kennedy was killed, and it was aired, as we said, the evening of the assassination. Everybody heard what you just heard, and, well, what conclusions do you think they were supposed to draw?